here. I have not seen you for a long time, nor had any of your succulent fruit. Would that be what you bear with you? No, indeed, I answered shortly, his voice grating on me as always, for the earth is parched to dust, and all that I grew is dead. The rains failed, as you know. Yes, 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 he said, looking at me with his cunning eyes. Those are hard times for us. Not for you, I thought. You thrive on others' misfortunes. We need money for the land, I said. I have brought the 2 shirts my sons no longer need, being away, 2 saris I never wear, and my husband's dhoti to sell to you. The saris are very finely worked and worn but a few times. I took them out and laid them before him. He fingered the rich stuff and measured the borders between outstretched thumb and little finger, and lifted up the silver threads to examine them closer, and held up the shirts to the light for sign of wear. How much do you want for these? It is for you to make the offer. Tell me first how much you want, and I will see what I can do. Enough to pay the land dues. How much is that? It is my business. He was silent for a while, and I said to him, exasperated, tell me if you are not prepared to buy, and I will go elsewhere. Always in a haste, he rebuked me in that gentle, oily voice of his. Yet I think this time you will have to await my pleasure, Rukmani. What do you mean? I said, ruffled. There are many who would be pleased to buy such material. I think not, he said. I think not, for you see, the wives of other men have come to me, even as you have, and have gone away as you threaten. Yet they have come back to me because nobody else can afford to buy these in hard times. As no doubt you can, I said with contempt, and then an inspiration came to me and I went on. Unless you pay a fair price, I shall take these saris elsewhere. There is the Muslim wife of a tannery official whom I know, and she will buy them from me as she has done before. Indeed, he said, a little disconcerted. Well, Rukmani, since we have done business for a long time, and because you are a woman of spirit, whom I have long admired, I will give you 30 rupees. Nobody could be fairer. Fairer by far, I retorted. I will not take 1 pie under 75 rupees. Take it or not as you please. I put the clothes away, making a pretense of going to the door. I hoped he would call me back, for in truth I did not know where else to turn. But if not, well, 30 rupees was too far from our needs to be of use, and if I did not get what I might ask for, I might as well keep the saris. As I got to the door, he called to me. Very well, Rukmani, I will pay you what you ask, since it will help you. I waited. He disappeared into another room and came back in a few minutes with a sour face and a small leather pouch full of money. He pulled the drawstrings and took it from notes and silver, counting them twice over to make sure. A very rare price, he said, handing me the money. Remember always the good turn I have done you. I tucked the money away, making no reply, and I went back with a lighter step than I had come out. Nathan had returned too, having sold the pots and pans, the food and the bullocks. We pulled the money and counted it, and there was in all 125 rupees, not even half we had to pay. There is still the seed, Nathan said. We must sell that. What of the next crop? I said. If we sell the seed, we may as well give up the land too, for how shall we raise a new crop? It is better to be without the seed than bereft of the land in which to plant it. Seed is cheap. It can be bought. I can earn a few rupees, or perhaps my son's. How? I cried to myself. How? It is not my son every day at the tannery, and no one will look at him because of his brothers. And you, my husband, what chance have you when so many young men are festering in idleness? It will mean only a few rupees, I said. Let us not sacrifice the future of our immediate need. What is the alternative? He shouted. Do you think I am blind and do not see, or so stupid as to believe that the crops are raised without seed? Do you take me for a fool that... He was not shouting at me, but at the terrible choice forced upon us. This I knew, yet I could not prevent my throat contracting or force the tears back into their wells. Let us only try, I said with the sobs coming fast. Let us keep our hope for the next harvest. Very well, very well, Nathan exclaimed. Let us try, by all means. We may be kicking for our pains, but what of that? Anything to stop your wailing. Now go, do not cross me further. He is worried, I thought, smothering my sobs. He is distracted and does not mean to be harsh. I went inside and lay down, with the money tied to my body, and at last I dozed off into a troubled sleep. In the morning, Savaji came, and my husband took the money and counted it out in front of him. 125 rupees, he said, not half what we owe, but the best we can do without selling the seed for the next sowing. It would raise only a few rupees, I pleaded. Let us please keep it, and we will repay you twofold. It is not for me, Savaji answered. You make payment to another. What shall I say to him that I bring so little? You made me promise of half. Give us a little grace, Nathan said, dragging the words out. We will make full repayment and over after the next harvesting. So we stood and argued and begged, and in the end Savaji agreed to wait. He took the money and turned to go. Then he hesitated and said a little wistfully, what I do I must, for I must think of my own. I do not wish to be hard. May you prosper. May you prosper too, I whispered, hardly able to speak, for his words had left me defenseless. May the gods give you their blessing. And so he departed. The drought continued until we lost count of time. Day after day, the pitiless sun blazed down, scorching whatever still struggled to grow and baking the earth hard until at last it split and great irregular fissures gaped in the land. Plants died and the grasses rotted. Cattle and sheep crept to the river that was no more and perished there for a lack of water. Lizards and squirrels lay prone and gasping in the blistering sunlight. In the town, a water reservoir had been built for the tannery workers and their families. But now, others were allowed a limited quantity as well. So I journeyed every morning, and when I said how many there were, perhaps half a mud pot would be doled out, sometimes a little more, depending upon who was in charge. Then some of the women, in their greed, began to claim to have more children than they had, and non-existent relatives. And there were jealousies and spite and bitter arguments, until at last it was decreed that each person must come in his own right only, not for others, even children and old men, and put an end to the cheating and quarreling. But it was hard for many who had not had their full strength. Then, after the heat had endured for days and days, our hopes had shriveled with the paddy, too late to do any good. Then we saw storm clouds gathering, and before long, the rain came lashing down, making up in fury for the long drought and giving the grateful land as much as it could suck and more. But in us, there was nothing left, no joy, no call for joy. It had come too late. Chapter 14. As soon as the rains were over and the cracks in the earth had healed, and the land was moist and ready, we took our seed to our goddess and planted it at her feet to receive her blessing. And then we bore it away and made our sowing. When a few weeks had gone by, the seed sprouted. Tender shoots appeared, thrusting upward with increasing strength, and soon we were able to transplant the seedlings one by one. And at first they stood out singly, slender, tremulous spires with spaces between, but grew and grew, and soon were merged into one thick green field of rustling paddy. In that field, in the grain which had not yet begun to form, lay our future and our hope. Hope and fear, twin forces that tugged at us first in one direction and then in another, and which was the stronger one, no one could say. Of the latter we never spoke, but it was always with us. Fear, constant companion of the peasant. Hunger, ever at hand to jog his elbow should he relax. Despair, ready to engulf him should he falter. Fear of the dark future, fear of the sharpness of hunger, fear of the blackness of death. Long before the paddy ripened, we came to the end of our dried fish stocks. There was no money left. Every pie had gone to pay the land dues. Nothing left to sell, nothing to be had from my efforts, for the vines and vegetables had withered in the long weeks of drought. At last, no option but to draw upon my secret hoard. A small stock of rice, 10 aleks in all, shielded from every temptation to sell or barter, kept even when they need to hold our land, had squeezed us dry of everything else. Now I brought it out, and I measured it again, 10 aleks exactly. Then I divided it into several equal portions, each of the portions as little as would suffice for one day, and counted the portions, of which there were 24, so that for nearly a month we would not starve. For a long time I hesitated, wondering whether we could do with less, thus making 30 divisions. But finally I decided against it, for Kuti was already ailing, and we needed to preserve our strength for the harvest. For at least 24 days we shall eat, I thought. At the end of that time, well, we are in God's hands. He will not fail us. Sometimes I thought that, and other times I was seized with trembling and was frightened, not knowing where to turn. The nights were always the worst, and could not for me alone. Peace then seemed to forsake our hut, and I could hear my husband and children moving restlessly in their sleep and muttering, whether from hunger or fear I do not know. Once Nathan cried out loudly and sprang in his sleep. I went to him, and he woke then and clung to me. "Only a dream," I said. "Sleep, my dear one." "A nightmare," he said, sweating. I saw the paddy turned to straw, the grain lost. Oh God, all was lost. His voice was stark, bereft of the power of disassembling which had full consciousness brings. "Never fear," I said, with a false courage, lest panic should swoop down on us. "All will be well." He composed himself for sleep again. "You are a good wife," he murmured. "I would not have any other." I drifted at last into uneasy sleep, and dreamt many evil dreams. And in one I saw a shadowy figure with no face creeping into our hut and bearing away the 10 olives of rice. I knew it was but the result of an overburdened spirit. But the following night I had the same dream. As the days passed, I found myself growing increasingly suspicious. Except for my family, I trusted no one. Only at night, when there was no passers-by, did I feel completely safe. Then I would bring out the rice and measure it, and run the grain through my fingers for sheer love of it, fondling it like a simpleton. When I had taken out the allotted portion for the next day, I would bury the remainder, one half tied in a white cloth in a hole I dug some distance from our hut, the other half in our granary. Several times I thought of going to Kenny, and twice did I go. He would have helped us of that, I'm sure, but each time I was told he had gone away. The townsfolk had not seen him for many weeks. I would have gone again and again, but I did not have my full strength. It was no longer easy to walk to the town and back. We might have borrowed from Beeswas, but there was nothing left to pledge. In any event, we would not have been able to pay the interest he demanded. 7 days went by, and 7 precious portions of rice were eaten. On the 8th day, Kunti came, and I was cooking the rice water. I had not set eyes on her for a considerable time, not since the day I had seen her in her nakedness, and she had changed so much I scarcely recognized her. I gazed at her hardly believing. The skin of her face was stiff and shiny, as if from overstretching. Everywhere it showed folds and wrinkles. Under her faded sari, her breasts hung loose. Gone was the tense suppleness that had been her pride and power. Of her former beauty, not a vestige remained. Well, I thought, all women come to it sooner or later. She has come off perhaps worse than most. "Sit and rest a while," I said. "What brings you hither?" She made no answer, but walked to the pot on the fire and looked in. "You eat well," she said, "better than most." "Not well. We eat, that is all." "You still have your husband?" "Why, yes," I said, staring at her, not quite taking her meaning. "Why do you ask?" She shrugged. "I have lost mine. I wondered how you had fared." "Poor thing," I thought. "She has suffered." I looked at her pityingly. "I do not want your pity," she said savagely. "Nor does my husband. He is alive and well. He is living with another." I thought of her husband, slow, sturdy, dependable, rather like an ox, and I could not believe it of him. Then I thought of Kunti as I had once seen her, with painted mouth and scented thighs that had held so many men, and I wondered if after all these years he had not at last found out about her. Perhaps the truth had been forced upon him, I thought, looking at her with suspicion, and I gazed again upon that ravaged beauty. "Stare your fill," she said scornfully. "You always lacked graces, Rukmani." I averted my eyes hastily. I hardly knew what to say. "I have come," she continued, "not to be seen or to see you, but for a meal. I have not eaten for a long time." I went to the pot and stirred it, scooped out a little, placed it in a bowl, and handed it to her. She swallowed it quickly and put the bowl down. I must have some rice, too. I cannot come every day. As it is, I have waited a long time to make sure you are alone. There is no rice to be given away, I said. I must think of my husband and children. These are not times of plenty. Nevertheless, she replied, I will have some. The damage will never be repaired while I hunger. There is no life for me until I am whole again. She is mad, I thought. She believes what she says, does not realize there is no going back for her. Listen, I said, there is none, or very little. Drink our rice water, come here daily, but do not ask for rice. I have a daughter and sons, even as you have, to consider. What I have belongs to us. Can you not go to your sons? My sons, she said, looking at me speculatively, are not mine alone. Seeing my bewilderment, she added, they have wives. I would never approach them now. What are sons for? I began. Not to beg from, she interrupted with a flicker of contempt. I can look after myself, but first the bloom must come back. I was mute. I had said all there was to say, and now there was nothing more. Well, she said, breaking the silence, and with what an edge to her voice. How much longer have I to wait? She came close to me and put her face near mine. I saw gray, drawn flesh in the hooded eyes, deep sunken in their sockets, and I made to turn away, but she held me. I have not so much patience, she said. I will have the rice now, or your husband shall hear that his wife is not as virtuous as he believes or she pretends. He believes what is true, I said with anger. I do not pretend. Perhaps he has not seen what I have seen, she said, and there was a menace in her voice and threat in her words. Comings and goings in the twilight, and soft speech and gifts of milk and honey, such as men make to the woman they have known. Stop, I howled at her, and put my hands to my ears. Thoughts kept hurtling through my head like frenzied squirrels in a new forged cage. With sudden clarity, I recalled my daughter's looks that far-off day when I had gone to Kenny. My son's words, such men have power, especially over women. Remembered my own foolish silences. I closed my eyes and sank down. She came and sat beside me. Which is it to be? Which is it to be? Her words were hammering at my brain. The horrible syllables were beating the air around me. The whole place was full of their sound. I need you, I cried to myself. Nathan, my husband, I cannot take the risk, because there is a risk, since she is clever and I am not. In your anger or your jealousy, or even because you are not yourself after these long, strained months, you may believe what she says and what she means, because I have deceived you and I cannot lie all that she proclaims. You may believe the more. I will kill her first, I thought, and the desire was strong. I felt myself shaking. I raised my hands to my eyes, and there was a quivering redness there. Then I heard a cry, whether of a bird or child or my own tortured self, I do not know, and the redness cleared. I felt the water oozing through my closed eyes, through my closed fingers. I took my hands away, and there was Kunti, waiting by my side, with the patience of one who knows what power she wields, patient like a vulture. The ration of 7 days to Kunti and 8 already eaten. There is still enough for 9 days, I thought, not with the comfort, but with desolation, and hatred came welling up again for her who had deprived me of the grain, and contempt for myself who had relinquished it. I waited a long time that night before going out, for fear that Kunti might be watching. There is nothing she would not do, I thought, lying there in the darkness. I must wait, and walk with care, and return unseen. I will match my wits against hers, I thought cunningly, lying and listening to uneasy slumber about me. And I will yet win, clever though she is. She shall not have all. I rose at last and went out softly, and looked about me, and went quickly to the hole I had dug and clawed away the earth until I saw the bundle, white under the starlight. I squatted down, crooning silently, untied it, ran my fingers through the grain, and I knew then there was no more than a handful left. A day's supply, no more, not the 9 days' supply I had looked to find. My stomach lurched. Blood came pounding to my head. I felt myself going dizzy. Who could have known? Who could have done this to me? I heard a voice moaning, and it was mine, and the sound was terrifying, for I had not meant to speak. I looked about me wildly, seeking to see even in the darkness. Nothing in sight, not a sound except my own